Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
In January of this year, Dennis Perry marked his 20th year in prison for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain, who were killed in the entryway of the Rising Daughter Baptist Church in 1985. That meant that for the first time, Dennis became eligible for parole under a Georgia law requiring inmates serving life sentences who were convicted before 2006 to serve 20 years in prison before parole could be considered. Of course, in practice, almost no one in Georgia convicted of murder before 2006 is paroled their first time before the board. Invariably, they receive a set-off and return a few years later, when almost as invariably, they are set off once again. They can usually expect to serve at least 30 years before parole is a serious possibility. So while Dennis Perry was theoretically up for parole, in practice it seemed that the best he might be able to hope for would be a set-off of only a couple of years. Worst case, they might set him off for half a decade or longer, as a parole board recently did to Joey Watkins. On June 3rd, though, the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles did something unexpected. They tentatively granted Dennis Perry parole, effective September 1st, if none of the members of the parole board changed their mind between now and then. Dennis Perry was granted parole, not a pardon. This decision does nothing to alter his conviction. But it does mean that, barring a change in plans, Dennis Perry will be paroled less than 2 months from now. That day cannot come soon enough. Coffee County Correctional, where Dennis is incarcerated, has 177 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is a special bonus update episode on the Dennis Perry case. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Back in April of this year, prior to the decision of the parole board to grant Dennis parole, Dennis's attorneys filed an extraordinary motion for a new trial on his behalf in Glynn County, where he'd been convicted back in 2003. The motion was based on new DNA evidence that had linked a man named Eric Sparr to the murders at Rising Daughter. And this past Monday, on July 13th, a hearing on Dennis's motion was held before Judge Stephen Scarlett in Glynn County Superior Court.
Stephen Scarlett presided.
Let me see, please.
Good morning.
All right, before the court's morning is State of Georgia versus Dennis Arnold Perry, the defendant's extraordinary motion for new trial.
At the hearing, Dennis was represented by his attorneys from the Georgia Innocence Project and from King and Spaulding. The state of Georgia, in turn, was represented by prosecutors John Johnson and Andrew Economou. John Johnson was the original prosecutor at Dennis's 2003 trial, and Andrew Economou recently served as impeachment counsel for President Donald Trump. He's not an employee with the state of Georgia, but he works as a part-time district attorney pursuant to a contract with the Brunswick Judicial Circuit.
Andrew Economou began the hearing by moving to deny the extraordinary motion for a new trial on the grounds that Dennis Perry had forfeited any right to prove his innocence with DNA evidence.
Your Honor, I would like to take the matter of appeal waiver up in the form of a motion in limine by the state to deny the extraordinary motion for new trial on the basis of appeal waiver, and I'm prepared to make that argument right now before we get into the evidence. The court may wish to take it under advisement, I understand.
However, as Phil Holliday of King and Spaulding noted for the defense, the prosecution had raised this argument for the first time just a few days previously, the Thursday before the hearing. The prosecution hadn't even filed anything with the court about its position.
Your Honor, I think our preference as the movement would be to hear the motion and have it presented as a defense. As I think we discussed in our conference on Friday, we've never been provided with a pleading that sets out the basis for the defense, the law in support of it. And so it would be our preference to just take it up as defense. But let me say this, Your Honor. We'll take it up whichever way you want to, if you'd like to hear it.
Mr. Does it matter to you?
Doesn't matter to me. I'll be happy to do it later.
We'll do it as a defense.
Argument that waiver was ultimately deferred until after the presentation of evidence, and Holliday began opening arguments for the defense by describing the new DNA evidence and the resulting discussions between the defense and District Attorney Jackie Johnson.
In late March of this year, Mr. Perry and his legal team obtained important new DNA test results that likely linked another suspect, Eric Sparr, to the key piece of physical evidence that was found by investigators at the crime scene. A pair of unique glasses that those investigators had long believed belonged to the killer. Recognizing the material significance of this new evidence, both to Mr. Perry's innocence claims, as well as to efforts to finally bring the Swains killer to justice, we immediately reached out and shared the new evidence with District Attorney Jackie Johnson. Over the next 3 weeks, we had what we then believed were constructive discussions with Ms. Johnson about the facts and circumstances surrounding Mr. Perry's arrest, trial, and wrongful conviction. We also shared with her at that time our very strong belief that the new DNA test results, at a minimum, entitled Mr. Perry to a new trial. Our hope was that given the obvious material significance of the DNA evidence, the DA's office would at least agree to either consent to the motion, or if they couldn't do that, just at least not to oppose it.
The defense had thought that these new DNA results, which plainly implicated Eric Sparr in the murders, might be relevant to the prosecution's consideration of Dennis Perry's claims of innocence. The defense had thought wrong.
Unfortunately, those efforts didn't work out, which is how we got here today. In a call on April 23rd, Ms. Johnson advised me that to move the process forward, we needed to go ahead and file our extraordinary motion for new trial. That very same day, the 23rd, continuing in the spirit of cooperation, we forwarded our draft motion, first time in 35 years practicing law that we've done that. Mr. Robinson wasn't a big fan of going ahead and sharing what we were going to do, but we wanted to be as transparent as we could about it, Your Honor. And so Mr. Perry, the following Monday, 2.5 months ago now, filed his extraordinary motion for new trial.
Under the case of Timberlake versus Georgia, Dennis Perry has a 6-point test he's required to meet in his request for a new trial.
The requirements for an extraordinary motion for new trial under Georgia law are set forth in the Timberlake case that we've cited in our pleadings, and they are straightforward. The new evidence must have come to Mr. Perry's knowledge since the trial. It was not owing to a want of due diligence by Mr. Perry that the evidence was not acquired earlier. The evidence is so material, it would probably produce a different result. The evidence is not cumulative only. If it involves witness testimony, the affidavit of a witness should be produced or in its absence accounted for. That's obviously not applicable here since we're talking about DNA test results. And then finally, the evidence must be offered for something other than simply to impeach the credibility of the witness. As set forth in our motion and the evidence accompanying it, the new DNA evidence reliably linking another suspect to the key piece of physical evidence found at the crime scene satisfies these requirements.
To DA Jackie Johnson, however, DNA evidence linking Eric Sparr to the crime was not persuasive evidence of Dennis Perry's innocence. And while in press releases, the DA's office has proclaimed that its only interest is in getting to the truth of what happened, the position the DA's office has taken in court is that Dennis Perry should be barred from ever presenting evidence of his innocence.
The DA's office has represented in its public pleadings to this court that it, quote, is the state's duty to ensure that truth wins in all cases, close quote, and, quote, that it has no interest in keeping an innocent man locked in prison, close quote. But notwithstanding these statements and statements from the DA to the press just last week, that, quote, we need to look at these things and get to the truth of the matter, close quote. The DA, as Mr. O'Connor mentioned before we got started, is now asking the court to avoid looking at these things and avoid getting to the truth of the matter. Shortly after Ms. Johnson's statement appeared in the Brunswick News, her office advised Mr. Perry's legal team in the court, not in a public filing with the court, but by email. Finally, it is the state's position that this extraordinary motion is barred by Perry's appeal waiver, just as his petition for habeas relief was barred on that same basis.
This is not a charge that the prosecution denies. In his opening arguments, Andrew Economou confirmed that the state's position was that Dennis Perry's claims of innocence should never be heard by a court.
Thank you. As I said, we are here today to recapitulate on a motion filed by the defendant Perry entitled Extraordinary Motion for New Trial, and this is critical, Judge, based on DNA evidence. I didn't put that in the title of the motion. They put it in the title of the motion. We believe that's barred for two reasons. One is an appeal waiver, and I was about to go through why I believe an appeal waiver obtains in this case. We know that he was convicted, Perry was, of the murder of the Swains in Camden Superior Court, in Glenn Superior Court, although the offense took place in Camden County, in 2003. That the state was seeking the death penalty, that he was convicted by the jury, and that it came time to submit the case of death or not to the jury. At that point, defense counsel and the state met, and the state decided, determined, agreed to remove the valuable right that it had to seek death, to remove that, and to agree to sentences of life.
In other words, at the time that Dennis Perry was convicted, the state had possessed something of value, the right to seek Dennis Perry's death. And the state had agreed to give up that right in exchange for Dennis Perry giving up his right to ever appeal his conviction. Therefore, it would be fundamentally unfair to ever allow Dennis Perry to appeal his conviction since the state gave up his thing of value to prevent such an appeal from ever happening. But even putting aside the basic immorality of this argument, there's a fundamental flaw with Economou's reasoning here. Because Dennis Perry isn't appealing his conviction. He has filed a habeas petition and an extraordinary motion for a new trial. Neither of these actions is an appeal of any sort. They're post-conviction proceedings, one under common law and one under statutory provision. And Dennis Perry never waived any right to post-conviction proceedings. Nevertheless, Prosecutor Economou argued, under recent Georgia case law, Dennis Perry had forfeited his right to post-conviction proceedings.
Now, Your Honor is familiar with the waiver of appeal, but I want to call the court's attention to a case that was decided almost exactly a year ago by the Supreme Court of Georgia, Brandt, B-R-A-N-T, the state, at 306 Georgia 235, decided June 24, 2019. And it's almost identical to the present case. It says Georgia allows a defendant to enter into a negotiated agreement to forego the right to seek post-conviction relief as a means to serve the interests of the state and the defendant in achieving finality. An important factor in that case is what the court concludes with. Contracts in general are a bet on the future. Plea bargains are no different. A classic guilty plea permits a defendant to gain a present benefit in return for the risk that he may have to forego future favorable legal developments.
Economou's argument is based on the Georgia Supreme Court's recent decision in Brandt v. State, a case which Economou claims is, quote, almost identical to Dennis Perry's case.
But that case is not almost identical. In fact, on the only point that matters here, it's the exact opposite of Dennis Perry's case. Because in Brandt v. Georgia, quote, at the plea hearing, the trial court asked Brandt if he understood that he was waiving his right of direct appeal and his rights to any post-conviction or collateral attack upon the guilty plea or sentence. Brandt replied that he understood. In other words, the Brandt case involved an explicit waiver of appellate and post-conviction rights, something that Dennis Perry never agreed to. But let's back up and pretend for a moment that Dennis Perry had made the deal that the prosecution now wishes it had made, but did not in fact make. Let's say that Dennis had waived his right to an appeal and to any and all post-conviction proceedings, as was done in Brand v. Georgia, and not just his right to appeal, which is what was actually done here. If we lived in that universe where Dennis had waived his post-conviction rights, as the state of Georgia wishes he had, what the state of Georgia is arguing is that because the state of Georgia paid valuable consideration in the form of giving up its right to execute Dennis Perry, then under no circumstances can the state be forced to relinquish that conviction. As such, when a defendant waives all post-conviction rights to avoid being executed, then his conviction can never be challenged, even if he is innocent, even if he can prove he's innocent, even if he has DNA evidence that shows who did the murders that he's in prison for. Even then, the prosecution is arguing, a defendant must be bound to the terms of his contract with the state. Because in order to induce that defendant to give up his right to challenge his conviction, the state had to give up something valuable. And therefore, it'd be fundamentally unfair to the state to deprive it of the benefit of its bargain. Perhaps sensing that the court might not be entirely persuaded by this line of argument, Prosecutor Economou had also prepared an alternative argument for the court's consideration.
If the court chooses to hear evidence, however, Your Honor, let's look at the title of the motion. Extraordinary motion for a new trial based on new DNA evidence. The only thing we should be hearing here today, if anything, and I don't think we should be hearing anything but whether they have the plea was voluntarily or involuntarily entered into. The only thing that should be heard from today, from the defendant, is DNA. That's it. We're not here to try Eric Spahr or anybody else. We're not here to try Dennis Perry again. He's been tried, he's been convicted, it's over. The only thing that we are here today to hear, if the court chooses to hear that and wishes to defer ruling on the appeal waiver, is put up your DNA evidence and let's hear that. Because, Your Honor, I'm going to be objecting to anything that is not relevant to the DNA evidence. And that's all I've got to say in opening. Thank you.
Economou was arguing that if the court were to insist on hearing this motion, which the court shouldn't do in the first place, Economou argued, because Dennis Perry had waived his right to such a hearing, if nevertheless the court decides to go ahead and hear it, well, in that case, the court should be prohibited from considering any evidence outside of the piece of paper that the DNA test results appear on. This is a motion based on DNA evidence, Economou told the court. It's right there in the title. As such, Economou argued, the judge may, if it wishes, consider the fact that DNA links the glasses found at Rising Daughter to a man named Eric Spahr. But the court may not consider any of the other evidence that links Eric Spahr to this crime. Evidence such as his many confessions, or his missing glasses that match the ones found at Rising Daughter, or the evidence of his means, motive, and opportunity to commit the crime. The judge rejected both the prosecution's arguments. In the end, at the hearing on Monday, Dennis's attorneys presented not just the new DNA evidence, but also a number of other witnesses who presented evidence that linked Eric Spahr to this crime.
The first witness call was the DNA analyst from Mitotyping Technologies, the lab that performed DNA testing back in 2002 on the hair samples from the church glasses, as well as the testing done earlier this year on the hairs from Gladys Spahr, Eric Spahr's mother. She testified that not only did the mitochondrial DNA profile from the crime scene match the mitochondrial DNA sample from Spahr's mother, but that his profile was in fact a rare one in North America.
The population frequency would be estimated at 0.26%, and it would exclude 99.744% of the population as having this type.
So when we say 0.26%, can you tell us in plain terms what that means with respect to whether...
Another way of looking at this is that if you randomly went out and sampled the North American population, for every 10,000 people, you would expect to see this profile 26 times.
Okay. Out of 250 people chosen at random, how many people would be expected to match this mitochondrial DNA profile?
That would be less than one.
GBI agent Joe Gregory also testified. As the DNA analyst, however, Agent Gregory did not appear in court to testify in person. Of course, we're in a pandemic, and getting witnesses in the courtroom isn't always possible. So rather than delay the hearings endlessly and deprive defendants of their day in court, many courts around the country have begun holding hearings remotely, with defendants and witnesses, and sometimes even attorneys, appearing via video conferencing software. And so, Agent Gregory made his appearance at Dennis's hearing over the court's WebEx platform. But holding court hearings remotely is a new experience for most courtrooms that are attempting them. And like with a lot of things during this pandemic, it's been a bit of a learning experience for everyone.
Okay. All right, you with us?
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Good. My computer is saying that the host has removed me from the meeting.
We removed one of you.
Eventually, the tech issues got ironed out, and Joe Gregory was able to testify about his investigation into the Swain case. And in particular, his efforts to investigate Eric Sparr in 1986, after his first wife, Emily Head, reported to the Camden County Sheriff's Office that he had confessed to killing the Swains. On cross-examination, John Johnson focused many of his questions on what had happened with the initial investigation into Eric Sparr and why Gregory had ultimately dropped that line of investigation.
So you found nothing at the search warrant. You also, on the 13th, if I'm not mistaken, you contacted Lee Optical in Glen Place Mall to see if either Eric Sparr or his dad had glasses there. Would that be correct?
That's correct, sir.
And did they?
No, sir. The people there said that particular store was never prepared. Glasses for you.
On March 27th, you received a phone call from Donald Mobley, manager of Winn-Dixie, and you verified with him, or at least he told you, and you wrote a summary, that Sparr clocked in at 3:06 on the 11th in the afternoon and clocked out March 12th, 6:41 a.m. Co-workers said that he had been there all night, and you knew him at that point to be a night stock clerk. That's a correct statement of what your summary says. Is that not correct?
If I'm understanding you correct, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Bob Lee, or whoever I spoke to, stated that he worked from 3 in the afternoon till 6 the next morning.
Right. Because of this, the search warrant, the information you got from Mr. Mobley, you discounted Eric Sparr as a suspect in this case, and you did no further investigation of him.
No, sir, we did not discount him as a suspect. That's why the summaries pertaining to Mr. Sparr were left in the active case file. It's just that at that time, he was not our primary suspect in the case.
What evidence did you have that he was, other than the statement that he made, what other physical evidence did you have that he was in Glen County on the night of March the 11th, 1985, at approximately 9 p.m. that evening? What evidence did you have? Any?
You mean pertaining to Mr. Sparr?
Yes, any?
We did not have any other evidence that particular night as to his work.
What evidence did you have?
This whole line of cross-examination might make sense if we're coming from a defense attorney questioning Agent Gregory at Eric Sparr's trial, but it makes less sense coming from a hearing on an extraordinary motion for a new trial in which Dennis Perry has the burden of proving the evidence implicating Sparr is new and was unavailable to him at the time of trial. If anything, this line of cross-examination seems designed to strengthen Dennis's case in this point by emphasizing how radically important this new DNA evidence is to the case and how it would have changed everything had it been available back in 1986.
And, of course, any exculpatory significance that Gregory's testimony about Sparr's alibi might have had was erased in full by the next witness Dennis's defense called, David Mobley, the manager of the Brunswick Winn-Dixie.
While you worked at Winn-Dixie, did you ever speak to law enforcement about the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain?
No.
Do you think that an interview by law enforcement about the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain is the kind of thing that you would remember today?
Most definitely.
Have you ever gone by the name Donald Mobley?
No.
Do you know anyone by the name Donald Mobley?
No.
Is your phone number now, or has it ever been 912-264-0707?
No.
Did you ever tell any law enforcement officer that Eric Sparr was at work the evening of March 11th, 1985?
Not that I recall.
It's not clear who Agent Gregory actually spoke to and who told him the things that are written down in his reports. But what Mobley's testimony does make clear is that Eric Sparr does not have an alibi for the night of the murders. The defense's next witness was Claire Gilbert, the executive director of the Georgia Innocence Project. She was brought in to testify not about Dennis Perry's case, but to demonstrate the due diligence that was done on Dennis Perry's behalf.
Once I got up to speed on Mr. Perry's case and other cases, it became clear to me that he was going to need some broad-scale investigation in his case to see if there were any other options or legal avenues available for him, which exceeded GIP's capacity at the time. I was the only attorney on staff. In fact, initially I was the only employee on staff. And so what I did was function sort of at the executive director level to take some steps to try and get him help and get his case moving. I reached out to a large firm that I felt might have the resources and who had expressed an interest in doing a big death penalty-like case, and this was certainly big enough to meet that criteria. However, after reviewing it for a while, they indicated that it was too much for them. The investigation was going to be too intensive. They chose not to take the case. I worked with a previous attorney to try and pitch the case to a couple of podcasts that might be able to provide investigative support. And eventually, the undisclosed podcast expressed an interest in taking on and reporting on the case and doing some sleepy investigative work.
So just in case, Ms. Gilbert, for the court, what is undisclosed and what is a podcast?
A podcast is like a radio program that you can access through the internet. It can be any number of different things. The undisclosed podcast is produced by a team of three attorneys who focus on wrongful conviction or innocence cases, and they attempt to reinvestigate those cases and report on them.
We began working on Dennis Perry's case in 2018, but investigation alone wouldn't help Dennis. Whatever our reinvestigation uncovered, it would mean nothing unless Dennis also had the resources to get back into court.
So once the podcast came on board, it became very clear to me that I would have to really ramp up efforts again to get him representation. So with the fact that the podcast was coming on board and would be interested, I approached the law firm of King & Spalding and pitched the case to them, and they fortunately agreed to come on board at that time.
When King & Spalding agreed to represent Dennis Perry, it meant for the first time he had a real shot of fighting his conviction. Because we cannot overstate the scale of the operation that it has taken to get Dennis's case this far. As described in an affidavit accompanying Dennis's motion filed with the court in April, quote, 22 King & Spalding employees have collectively spent over 3,080 hours working on Mr. Perry's case. And that was before the last 3 months of preparing for the hearing. And that's not even counting the years of work poured into this case by GIP attorneys. When it comes to wrongful conviction cases, being innocent is never enough by itself. And in complicated cases like Dennis's, unless you have a team of people willing to donate legal services worth millions of dollars to work on your behalf, you may not have a chance. And even then, there are never any guarantees.
The remainder of the witnesses called by the defense were people who, at one point or another, had known Eric Spahr. One of those witnesses was Chad Head, whose sister Emily had been Eric Spahr's first wife. Emily had also been married to Spahr at the time of the murders of Rising Daughter. Emily was murdered in 2013 and not available to testify, but her brother Chad also had relevant information to share about Eric Spahr. Chad Head testified not from the witness stand, but rather from the driver's seat of his car, calling into the court's teleconferencing software on a cell phone. As with many of the witnesses who testified remotely at the hearing, things didn't always go smoothly.
Sir, is that a little better?
All right, yes, sir. That would
work. Okay. If you will, state your name for the record.
Chad Head.
And have you ever known someone named Eric Spahr?
Yeah, he is an ex-brother-in-law.
Ex-brother-in-law. Was he married to your sister?
Hey, sorry?
Was he married to your sister, Emily?
Yes.
Okay. And
you think it might be his cell phone?
Okay, I can hear you now. I can hear you better now.
Okay. Well, let's see if you can hear counsel.
All right. Is that any better, sir?
Can I proceed?
Yes, sir.
Just try that.
All right, Mr. Head, is this any better? Sir, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I can barely hear you.
Can you hear me any clearer now?
That's mute.
Okay.
Eventually, the court was again able to work the tech issues out. Well, more or less anyway. But they were fixed enough for Chad Head to be able to testify about his relationship with his brother-in-law, Eric Spahr.
Said, did he and my sister have problems?
Yes, sir.
He just wasn't a very good person. He was a woman beater.
Okay, can you give us a little more specifics on that?
As well, he stayed on drugs all the time, and he wanted to beat on her a lot.
Okay. And did y'all have a problem with that?
Any job problems?
No, did you all? You and your brother and family have a problem with all
that? He was always harassing us. When they split up, he would come down, and his family owned some property in behind our place, and he would go down and he would shoot all day long and shoot back toward the house and stuff like that, and he would call us up on the phone and harass all the time.
How often would he do that?
I don't remember. I don't remember how often, but it was a good bit. I don't remember all of the phone calls, but yeah, he always wanted to call and threaten to shoot the place up or to kill somebody or something like that. It was pretty constant. He just wanted to get her on the phone so he could. I don't know what he would tell her, but he wasn't pretty, whatever it was.
And it was because of this history of Spahr calling them up and threatening them that the Head family decided to purchase a call recorder.
And was there a time when you were recording the calls and you answered the phone?
Yes.
And what did Mr. Spahr say to you?
Objection, Your Honor, hearsay.
That would be hearsay. I'd give the perfect way to rule.
What did Mr. Spahr say to you when you answered the phone, sir?
When I answered the phone, he said, I'm the motherfucker to kill them niggers down at church, and I'm the motherfucker that's going to come and kill y'all.
And were you able to successfully record that?
Yeah, and that got recorded.
We've discussed this recording before, in episode 7 of season 3. At one time, there existed a cassette tape containing Eric Spahr's confession to the murder, and it was in the possession of the Camden County Sheriff's Office. But, like every other cassette tape and recorded witness interview from the initial investigation, that recording was lost by the time Bundy reopened the case in 1998. No one knows where those tapes are now. But after Eric Sparr had made his confession on the recorded phone call in 1986, Emily Head's family went to the police.
Did y'all call the police?
Yeah, we called that night. And it was Stanley Agee, Butch Kennedy, and Bill Smith came over to the house. And they played it for Bill, and they had brought two boxes in. And one box had glasses in it, one box had shirts in it. And they wanted my sister to look through them and see if she could identify any of them. And she immediately pulled out a pair of glasses that belonged to Eric, and she pulled out a shirt that belonged to him.
You've also heard about this lineup before on the podcast, or at least you've heard about part of it. Also in episode 7, we covered a report from Deputy Butch Kennedy where he explained how Emily had described to him that Eric lost a pair of glasses that were assembled from pieces of other glasses on a night that he'd come back late and was wearing a different shirt in about March of 1985. So Butch Kennedy had done a lineup of sorts, and he'd shown Emily three sets of glasses, the pair of glasses from the church entryway and two decoy pairs. And he asked Emily to pick out the pair that were Eric's. And she indeed picked out the pair that were found in the church. And Emily Head's brother Chad remembered all of this taking place, but he also remembered something else. He remembered that when the sheriff and the two deputies had come out to show Emily this lineup of the glasses, they'd also done a second lineup. They'd shown Emily a bunch of men's shirts and asked her to pick out the one that belonged to Eric, and she had done so. If you're thinking to yourself right now that you don't recall anything about any shirts being found at the crime scene, well, you're not wrong. There is no record of that anywhere. There were shirt buttons found, both from Harold Swain's shirt, as well as buttons from an unknown shirt that were scattered in the church entryway, buttons that presumably had been ripped off the killer's shirt during the scuffle. But as for an actual shirt being found at the scene, and being shown to Emily Head as part of the lineup, well, there's no sign of that anywhere in the file, at least not as it exists today. It could be that 35 years on, Chad Head is just misremembering what happened, and that no shirt was ever shown to his sister Emily. But his memory is so specific, and the rest of what he describes matches so well with the existing record, that it's hard to dismiss this as just an error. And after all, the idea that a shirt could have been found at the crime scene but was later lost doesn't seem impossible to believe, given the fact that's exactly what happened to the pair of glasses that were found in the church entryway. Camden County doesn't exactly have a great track record when it comes to not losing vital pieces of physical evidence.
Not all the witnesses at the hearing made their appearance via teleconference. Eric Sparr's second wife, Rhonda Tyson, appeared in person. This had the benefit of negating any tech problems, but in the COVID-19 era, this raised its own issues.
Good afternoon, Ms. Tyson.
Hi.
My name is Philip Green, thanks. If you will, state your full name for the court.
Rhonda Gail Tyson.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Tyson. Are you currently married?
No.
Have you ever been married?
Yes.
Who was your first marriage to?
Eric Sparr.
To Eric Sparr?
Correct.
How long were you married to Mr. Sparr?
Too long.
I can't understand.
Several years.
Just try to speak up. I know you got the mask on. Only you can take mask off.
I was going
to
say, can I take it off?
If
that's
you're comfortable
fine.
With
Thank
doing
you.
That, if you're comfortable doing
I'm
that.
I'm good.
Okay. All right.
Several years.
Eric Sparr's second marriage was, like his first marriage, a violent one.
Was Mr. Sparr ever violent towards you?
Extremely, yes.
Did there ever come an occasion where Mr. Sparr mentioned anything about having killed him?
Yes.
What did he say?
Objection, Your Honor, hearsay. The declarant is available. He could have been subpoenaed, could have been in court. This is an out-of-court statement offered in court for the truth of the declaration.
Sure, Your Honor. The inquiry is whether the admissible in the retrial of the case, in which case we would either call Mr. Sparr directly, and he would either affirm and the statements would come to evidence, or he would say something inconsistent and be impeached, or he would plead the fifth, and the statements would then come in through the witness. In any event, the inquiry is not whether they're admissible here, but whether they're admissible at trial.
No, we're here on a motion for a new trial. We're not trying the case. And I don't think the defense has really gotten that, really understood that today. We're not trying the case. The court has before an extraordinary motion for a new trial based on DNA evidence, as I read this morning. What she has been asked to say is what a declarant said to her to be offered in court for the truth of the assertion. And that is hearsay, and it's not admissible. Very simple.
It is hearsay. I'll give it the appropriate weight.
The court noted, as it did whenever the prosecution raised an objection to testimony about Eric Spahr's numerous confessions, that yes, this testimony was hearsay. But as the prosecutor also noted, this wasn't a trial. There was no jury. It's the judge evaluating the evidence, and he's able to weigh the hearsay evidence and give it the appropriate weight in reaching his decision. And therefore, Rhonda Tyson was allowed to testify about Spahr's statements to her.
Thank you. And I mean, also, yeah. What did Mr. Spahr say to you?
Quote, unquote, I will kill you like I killed those N-word in the church in Camden County.
And what were the circumstances at the time that he said that?
I was laying on the floor. He was straddling me on my chest with his hands around my throat.
Was he angry?
He was extremely violent at that time, yes.
Was he yelling and screaming at the time?
Yes.
Now, Rhonda Tyson was interviewed by Deputy Dale Bundy and GBI agent Ron Rhodes during the reopened cold case investigation back in 1998. By the time he learned about Rhonda Tyson, however, Deputy Bunny was already convinced that it was Dennis Perry who was responsible for the Swains' murder, which may explain why her testimony at Dennis's hearing is radically different from what's described in Agent Rhodes' report of that 1998 interview. Because at least according to Rhodes' report, Rhonda Tyson never told Bundy and Rhodes that Spahr actually confessed to the murders. Instead, Rhonda, according to Agent Rhodes' report, had told Spahr once that he could have killed the people at the church in Camden County, and he'd agreed with her. Yeah, he said, I could have killed them. The report of Rhonda's 1998 interview and Rhonda's testimony at the hearing cannot be reconciled. Someone isn't telling the truth about what happened back in 1998. Was it Rhonda? Did she change her story? Did she tell Deputy Dale Bundy and GBI agent Ron Rhodes something different back in 1998 than what she testified to under oath earlier this week? Or did Bundy and Rhodes fabricate the contents of a witness interview in order to downplay the significance of that witness's statement and in order to cover up significant evidence that pointed toward the guilt of someone other than Dennis Perry? Because if Rhonda Tyson was really lying under oath, then it should have been trivial for the prosecution to call either Bundy or Rhodes to the stand in order to impeach her, and to testify that back in 1998, she'd given them a different story. The prosecution, however, did not do that. And not because Andrew Economou decided against the strategy of attempting to impeach Rhonda Tyson. He did try to impeach her. He just pursued a different line of questioning to try and do so. And in the process, he managed to forget that we're all supposed to be social distancing right now.
May I approach the witness?
Yes, sir.
I want to show you, Ms. Tyson, is that what you know about?
Right.
What has been marked as State's Exhibit for Identification Number 8. Did you give that affidavit to the defense lawyers?
For corporate protocol purposes.
I'm sorry.
For COVID protocol purposes. Can we back off a little from
there? Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Okay.
I should have worn my mask too.
Yes.
That was your statement that you made, a sworn statement that
yes.
you gave to the defense attorneys?
Yes.
And that's included in that is Exhibit 8?
Yes.
State's Exhibit 8?
Yes.
Let me have that. Let me call your attention to Eric, to number 4. Eric is extremely violent. He beat me. Once when we were fighting, Eric put his hands around my throat and shouted, I'll kill you like I killed those two N's in Camden County.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you just testify you said in church in Camden County?
In the church. In
Why didn't you say that in this affidavit? You didn't, did you?
Not in the affidavit, no.
But now you're saying today that he said it was in church.
Yes.
When you gave the affidavit, you just said Camden County.
Yes.
Which is it?
In the church in Camden County.
Why didn't you say that?
Between the time that and now?
Yes.
There's a lot been going through my mind about Eric Spahr.
So you put a little bit more things into your mentality about it, right?
No.
Thank you.
Economou was attempting to impeach Rhonda Tyson based on an alleged discrepancy between the affidavit she provided to Dennis's counsel and her testimony in her direct examination. In the affidavit she recently provided, she described how Eric Spahr told her he'd, quote, killed those two ends in Camden County. In her testimony, she said Eric Spahr told her he killed them in the church in Camden County. What Economou was attempting to do was to cast Rhonda Tyson as having altered her testimony to make it more incriminating, to make it clear the confession she'd heard had to do with the murders at Rising Daughter instead of some other murder somewhere in Camden County. But in fact, we have very compelling evidence that Rhonda's statement on this point has been consistent for over two decades. Because in her very first statement to the police, as recorded by GBI agent Rhodes' memo, what Rhonda allegedly said was that she had said to Spahr, quote, you could have killed those people in that church in Camden County, and Spahr had agreed. There is a conflict there as to whether Rhonda Tyson first said that Spahr had confessed or merely said he could have committed the crime. But the part about killing the people in the church in Camden County is exactly the same. That's the same in her statement in 1998 and in her testimony in 2020. But Economou's attempts at impeachment didn't end there.
Now, you said he beat you up, right? Stabbed you and cracked your cheekbone, broke your nose and all that, right?
Yes.
Did you make a police report?
No.
Why not?
Because I got away from him and I stayed away from him.
Why didn't you go to the police and explain that he had assaulted you and beat you up?
Because they did nothing the last time and the time before that and the time before
that. So you had made police reports in the past, but you're saying the police never did anything, right?
No.
They just let him get away with it.
I didn't say that.
Well, you didn't go to the police to try to make a complaint about the fact that he stabbed you and did all these things to you. You didn't say that in the affidavit, did you?
No. That's not pertinent to this case.
Hold on one second.
I object to harassing and abusing the witness.
I'm cross-examining.
Got it on call, so we're okay.
So you never made police reports before. You made police reports before, but they didn't do anything, right?
No.
So these police reports here, you didn't make them because there was no reason to make them, right?
No, that's not what I said.
Well, what'd you say?
I said they did nothing.
The police did nothing.
The police did nothing.
Yeah, what you heard there was the specially hired prosecutor for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit trying to impeach the testimony of a domestic violence victim on the basis that she had eventually stopped reporting her abuser's assaults to the police. Because the prior time she'd gone to the police about his assaults, nothing had happened. And so, Prosecutor Economou insinuated in his cross-examination, Rhonda Tyson's failure to file a police report against her abuser each and every time he assaulted her is a reason for the fact finder, meaning the judge, to conclude that her testimony is inherently less trustworthy because by her own admission, she didn't always go to the police every time her abuser committed a crime against her. Meanwhile, it should be noted the prosecution in this case has also taken the position that the fact Jane Beaver was promised a monetary award if her testimony resulted in Dennis's conviction and the fact that she received that reward was not relevant evidence for impeaching her testimony. And the prosecutor John Johnson acted appropriately by withholding this information from the defense, even when he had personally spoken to Jane Beaver about her interest in the reward prior to Dennis's trial.
There are a few other parts of Rhonda Tyson's testimony that are worth highlighting here. For instance, Rhonda confirmed a few key details about Spahr that would support the hypothesis that the hairs found in Rising Daughter were in fact the hairs of Eric Spahr.
Did Mr. Spahr have any guns?
Yes.
Did he have just one or multiple?
Multiple.
Did he wear glasses?
Sometimes, yes.
Was he a welder?
He had welded, yes. He knew how.
Did he ever work at the Episcopal Center over at Honey Creek?
Yes, he did.
Rhonda testified that Spahr was a welder. This is significant because the glasses found in the church entryway had slag marks in them, indicating the owner had in fact worn the glasses while welding. Rhonda also testified that Spahr worked over at the Episcopal Center on Honey Creek, which is in Waverly off of Dover Bluff Road, and just a few miles down the road from Rising Daughter. And this detail from Rhonda's testimony may also be significant. Because on the day that he was murdered, Harold Swain had been at a house over on Honey Creek next to the Episcopal Center, where he was performing some odd jobs for his friend Steve Rall. Harold Swain had been paid $300 for his help, and Harold then left Honey Creek to go attend Bible study at Rising Daughter. The $300 was still in his pocket when he was killed. So now that the GBI has reopened its investigation into the Swain case, one thing we hope they're looking into is whether Spar was working at the Episcopal Center on the day the Swains were killed. If so, that could potentially show Spar's motive and opportunity to commit the crime. But, as Rhonda Tyson also testified, when it comes to Spar's potential motivation for killing the Swains, there's another possible explanation as well.
And what was Mr. Spar's attitude towards African Americans?
I object, Your Honor. Irrelevant. Has nothing to do with this case. What Mr. Spar's has nothing to do with the motion for new trial in this case that's been filed by Dennis Perry. What Eric Spar's view toward African Americans is has nothing to do with it, does
it? I can respond. Yes, sure. We put on DNA evidence this morning, Your Honor. And the state has, in the pleading and in the cross-examination, attacked the DNA evidence as saying it cannot isolate a specific individual. However, the witness this morning made clear that the DNA evidence has to be considered in force with motive, opportunity, means, and other evidence in the case. This goes to corroborate the materiality of the DNA evidence that we put on this morning.
Overruled.
Thank you. Right. What was Mr. Spar's attitude towards African Americans?
He did not like them very much.
Can you give us any sort of description of how he would show his attitude that he wouldn't? That he did not like African Americans very much? Can you be any more specific?
He would blatantly use the N-word.
Did you ever
out the windows, screaming at them? Yes.
Did you ever hear him claim to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan?
Yes. His claim.
Aside from the statements of a jailhouse snitch who was later deemed to be so lacking credibility that the prosecution declined to call him at Dennis Perry's trial, there has never been a scrap of evidence that Dennis Perry has harbored racist animus against anyone. I've spoken to his friends and family and acquaintances from all stages of his life, including people of color who were close personal friends of Dennis, and no one has ever told me anything that might support the state's theory that Dennis Perry killed the Swains because he wanted to, quote, find out what it was like to kill an N-word. And yet the jury had believed that's why Dennis killed the Swains. And the relatives of the Swains and others in Camden County also believe that's why Dennis killed the Swains. But what would they have believed if instead they had been given the opportunity to hear the evidence that a welder who was missing a pair of glasses like the ones found in Rising Daughter was also a self-proclaimed member of the KKK and had repeatedly confessed to committing the murders? It seems like that alone could have resulted in a different outcome at Dennis's trial. And that's before ever even getting to the DNA evidence. Finally, Dennis Perry's defense called Jennifer Tyre, who had once been acquainted with Eric Spar through her ex-husband.
Sorry, what was that?
Do you know a man named Eric Spar?
I do.
And how did you meet Mr. Spar?
I met Mr. Spar back in 1998. Through an ex-husband of mine and my stepfather. They all
work
together on the
Sydney
Lanier Bridge.
Are you still in touch with Mr. Spar today?
I am not.
I want to talk to you about a birthday party that you attended for your ex-husband. About when was that party?
It was, I want to say, October of 1999, or October 2000.
And I understand that you remember Mr. Spar talking about some violence in the past. And if you could share with the court the conversation that we're referring to.
Okay. Am I to say it word for word?
Yes, but you can use the N-word instead of the other language.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Your Honor, I object to anything that she says that someone told her as being hearsay, and also it's irrelevant.
If it is hearsay, I'll give you the perfect way. Go ahead.
You may go ahead, Ms. Tyre.
What do I need to do?
You can... No, it's okay. You can go ahead and just... You can use the word N-word instead of the actual word when you describe the conversation or describe what he said to you.
and like I said, I do not know what was being said up to this point, but Eric said to me that he had killed some black workers, some N-words in the past, and he would not be afraid to do it again.
King and Spalding attorney Phil Holliday told the court they had no further witnesses to call. And then it was the prosecution's turn to present its case to the court as to why Dennis Perry's conviction should not be overturned.
We need a witness.
No, Your Honor, we have no other witnesses at this point.
Did you come?
No witnesses, just argument.
No witnesses, Andrew Economou told the court. Just argument. The prosecution declined to present any evidence at the hearing and rested its case without calling a single witness or introducing a single document into evidence. Which was the prosecution's right to do. The burden at this hearing is all on Dennis Perry, and the state can win without putting on any evidence in support of its case. And if the state thought that it did not have any evidence to present that would be helpful to it, then not presenting evidence was the right strategic call. But the goal of a prosecutor is not just to win court hearings, it's to do justice. And if John Johnson and Andrew Economou and DA Jackie Johnson truly believe that Dennis Perry's continued imprisonment is in the interest of justice, then surely they have some evidence of some sort that supports that belief, right? But here, the District Attorney's Office for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit never once in the entire hearing offered an explanation for why, as a substantive matter, Dennis Perry's conviction should not be overturned. The DA's office never even argued that there's reason to believe Dennis Perry is guilty. Instead, their sole argument is that Dennis Perry should be prohibited from asking the court to overturn his conviction in the first place. The position that the DA's office has taken is that 17 years ago, they won the prize of being able to put Dennis Perry in a cage forever by agreeing to forego their right to kill him. And that it's now unfair for Dennis Perry to ask the court to take that prize away from them by undoing the bargain that they wished they'd made with him back in 2003, but never actually did make. That argument that Dennis Perry waived his right to ever challenge his conviction is now pending before the court, with the parties agreeing to submit briefs on their positions for the court's consideration later this week. But the good news is, Judge Stephen Scarlett does not intend to let the waiver issue delay his decision for long.
And I look forward to seeing the proposed orders and the briefs by Thursday. Of course, intention to rule by this week.
The court's intention, Judge Scarlett said, is to issue a ruling on Dennis's extraordinary motion for a new trial by the weekend. That means by Friday, we'll have an answer. And what happens then? Well, if the judge denies Dennis's motion, he can appeal, and he can hope the Supreme Court of Georgia will agree to hear the case. Either way, as things stand now, Dennis will be paroled in September. He won't be free of the criminal justice system, not entirely, but he'll have the chance to return home to his family. And if the judge grants Dennis's motion and overturns the conviction, the state can appeal that decision. And if they do, the Supreme Court of Georgia is obligated to hear it. Which would mean, for the next year or longer, Dennis will go through the appeal process, though he'll likely be released on parole before a Supreme Court hearing date could ever be scheduled. And if Dennis wins that appeal, and the Supreme Court upholds the decision from the trial court overturning his conviction, what happens then? Well, that'll be for DA Jackie Johnson to decide. If Dennis has been released on parole at that time, well, his parole will no longer matter. Jackie Johnson will have the option to have Dennis Perry recharged with capital murder and seek the death penalty against him once more, and have him returned to jail pending trial. Would the DA ever win such a trial? Not in this case. Normally, I would never feel that sort of optimism about the outcome of a murder trial because there are no guarantees about what a jury will do, but here, no. I do not think the state would win a conviction against Dennis again. But what DA Jackie Johnson can do is reincarcerate Dennis Perry for 2 or 3 years, maybe longer, in the hope that she can force him to enter into a plea deal. So, one way or another, this isn't over for Dennis Perry yet. There are still a lot of hurdles ahead. But after 20 years in prison for a crime he didn't do, maybe, just maybe, by this Friday, Dennis Perry will be one step closer to winning his freedom. Thank you.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
4th of July deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, including the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator, featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Now's the perfect time to upgrade your home with top Samsung appliances and hot 4th of July savings at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com. Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.